Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, yeah. I just want to thank you for this opportunity for Barry and his wife to make this possible for me and my wife to be here, to come to visit Mexico City. I want you to tell you the truth. Most Canadians, they don't come to Mexico City. I want to go home to tell them, if you haven't visited Mexico City, you don't know Mexico at all. Mexico is not just a beach. Mexico is not just an all-inclusive hotel. Is that right? I'm so thankful I come to see you guys and see this city. It's a wonderful city. Yes, a lot of people. China, a lot of people too. Right? All right. So, if you have the Bible with you, if you have your smartphone with you, turn with me to the Gospel of John, chapter 8, 1-11. The Gospel of John, chapter 8, 1-11. And I will be reading from the Amplified Bible. Okay, Gospel of John, chapter 8, verse 1. But Jesus went to the Mount of Olives early in the morning at dawn. He came back into the temple court, and the people came to him in crowds. He sat down and teaching them. When the scribes and Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, they make her stand in the middle of the court and put the case before him. Teacher, they said, this woman has been caught in the very act of adultery. Now Moses, in the law, commanding us that such woman, that type of woman, that offenders, that type of person shall be stoned to death. But what do you say to do with her? What is your sentence? This they said to try to test him, hoping they might find a charge on which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger. However, when they persisted with their question, he raised himself up and said, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. Then he bent down and went on writing on the ground with his finger. They listened to him, and then they began going out, conscience-stricken, one by one, from the oldest down to the last one of them, till Jesus was left alone with the woman standing there before him in the center of the court. When Jesus raised himself up, he said to her, woman, where are your accusers? Has no man condemned you? She answered, no one, Lord. And Jesus said, I do not condemn you either. Go on your way, and from now on, sin no more. We heard this gospel account from a man, the disciple John. Now, let us hear from the woman herself. Let us hear from the woman herself. Because of Jesus, this woman lived to tell her story. Because of Jesus, we all live to tell our own story. And this is her story from walking with gospel woman. I felt a rough hand on my shoulder, pushing me toward Jesus, causing me to stumble and fall at his feet. I kept my eyes down, knowing that the gaze of the whole crowd was fixed on me. Teacher, one of the Pharisees said, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses said she should be stoned to death. What do you say? There was a complete hush. Jesus was trapped, I knew it. How could he disagree with the law of Moses? There was no alternative. He would have to condemn me to death. My body started to shake uncontrollably. As I crouched there, my face in my hands, the silence was broken by a scratching sound. I raised my head slightly to see what was going on and realized Jesus had bent over, was writing in the dust with his finger quite close to me. What was he writing? What was he writing? Only the teachers and I were close enough to see. It was the commandments that God had given to Moses, starting with, "You must have no other God before me." The teachers of the law and the Pharisee grew impatient, demanding a reply to the question. And Jesus just continued writing, "You must not make for yourself an idol of any kind. Answer me! Answer us," one shouted. "You must not misuse the name of the Lord your God," he wrote. Then he stood up and looked straight at them. "The one who has never sinned should be the first one to throw a stone." At that moment, I heard a wail, and my heart was torn apart. It was the cry of my son. Instinctively, my eyes turned in the direction of the cry, and there he was, standing next to my husband, clinging to him, his face streaked with tears. My eyes met those of my husband for just a second, and I saw there the agony of a betrayed man. I saw Jesus look at them too. His eyes were filled with deep compassion, as if he understood pain and betrayal. He bent over again and continued to write, "Remember to observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy." I heard desperate shouts for mercy and realized that they were coming from my own lips. In self-protection, I curled my body over my knees, wrapping my hands around my head, awaited the first blow. Silence. Only the scratching of the writing was audible. "Honor your father and mother." The stillness was broken by the sound of footsteps, at first near and then fading away into the distance. Silence again. Then the scratching continued. "You shall not murder." There were more footsteps. I hardly dare read what Jesus wrote next. "You shall not commit adultery." My shame and my pain well up inside me. I want to talk to this rabbi to explain and to try to justify myself. I had not set out to be unfaithful to my husband. It was years of loneliness and absence of gentle words, loving touch, sheer laughter, and then discovery of all these in the arms of another man. I have taken a terrible risk to feel alive and wanted. The words remain written in the dust in front of me, so close that I could touch them. I sent movement behind me. Surely now that they could see these words, the first stone would be thrown. But there was not a thud, not a word. So the silence and scratching continued. "You must not steal," Jesus wrote. All the while the crowd was motionless, while behind me the footsteps continued, at first loud and then dying away. "You must not testify falsely against your neighbor." Bit by bit, I strengthened my body. I dared to turn to look. They have left. Every single one, religious leader, have gone. On the edge of the crowd, I could see my husband and son waiting. Waiting for what? "You must not covet." Jesus stood up looking at me. "Is that not what I've been doing, coveting what I did not have?" Jesus slowly took in the scene around me, around him, the crowd, my family, empty space where the Pharisee has stood. He said gently to me, where are those who accuse you? Does not even one of them condemn you? No, Lord. No, sir. I whisper. With great authority and for all to hear, Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Now go and sin no more. Now, let us look at the gospel scene. In this gospel scene, there's a temple court. There's a crowd of people. That's the woman, Jesus, the scribes and Pharisees. That's the gospel scene. Now, let's look at the culture at that time, the culture of Jesus' time. The culture at that time is a shame and honor culture, a shame and honor society. Men in a shame and honor society are supposed to have a good control of the woman, to keep the woman in line. And when the woman, the wife, engaged in adultery, nowadays we call affairs, she brought shame to the man. The husband, in order to bring honor back to the man had to get rid of the woman who is seen as a pollutant to the family, a pollutant to the family, to the community, to the whole town. And when you get rid of her, you cannot touch her. Why? Because she's a pollutant. She's morally unclean. She's contagious. And therefore, stoning her is a way to get rid of her without touching her. In this gospel scene, the whole community shamed the woman. She probably naked or half naked. I can hear the crowds from old to young, men and women are shouting and calling her names. Whore, whore, whore. Slut, slut, slut. Bitch, bitch, bitch. Horrible, horrible, horrible names. We call women and girls when they engage in sexual misconduct. Have you experienced someone calling you names when you're growing up? Have you experienced someone calling you names when you were in school? Have you experienced someone calling you names growing up in your family? Have you experienced someone calling you names in relationships? In your own marriage, the woman must feel alone. She must feel so alone and abandoned. Do you know what is the worst thing a man can do to a woman? The worst thing a man can do to a woman is to make her feel alone, to make her feel afraid, to make her feel not feeling safe. Alone in the marriage, alone to do everything in the home, alone and cannot connect with her husband. Do you know what is the worst thing a woman can do to a man? The worst thing a woman can do to a man is to make him feel inadequate. Nothing I do is good enough for you. Nothing I do meet your standard and expectation. Nothing I do is spiritual enough for you. This woman must feel so ashamed and unworthy. The crowds are calling her nasty names and chanting, you're no good. You're no good to your husband. You're no good to your family. You're no good to your community. You're no good to your synagogue. You're no good to your church. It's not what she has done is no good. It's who she is, a person, is no good to the husband, the family, and the community. You know, there's a difference between guilt and shame. There's a difference between guilt and shame. Guilt tells you you make a mistake, but shame tells you you are the mistake. Guilt tells you you have a problem, and shame tells you you are the problem. Shame is always about the person, you. And shame comes with tremendous emotional pain because shame is telling you with all these shame tapes and all these shame attack. Shame attack. I am unworthy. I am stupid. I'm ugly. I'm fat. I'm inadequate. A mistake. A nothing. I'm useless. I am a loser. I'm no one. I'm nothing but a failure. I'm too old to be of much importance anymore. I can't do anything right. I'm not a good spouse. I'm not a good mother. No one would love me if they knew all my secrets. Can't believe God would forgive me for what I have done. No one would want me. There's something wrong with me. It's a shame attack. And guilt and shame are universal because it does not matter where you come from. Does not matter the color of your skin. Does not matter if you're Mexican or Chinese or American or Canadian. Because guilt and shame are all dating back to the Garden of Eden. When the man and woman disobeyed in the Garden of Eden, right away they know they've done something wrong. That's guilt. And you quickly find something to cover up the body. When they find out the Creator looking for them in the garden, they are so scared, they want to hide because they know they're not worthy to see God, and that is shame. We all have guilt and shame. However, if you come from a family history of addiction, like my dad, my grandfather's alcoholic, if you come from a family history of abuse, verbal, emotional, physical, sexual, if you come from a family history having a parent who is so controlling, who is so critical, nothing you do good enough for her, the shame and the pain is tremendous. And in order to make the pain of shame more bearable, we do three things. And called the three P's by Dr. Brené Brown, a shame researcher out of Houston, Texas. And the three P's are pleasing, performing, perfecting. Pleasing, performing, perfecting. Pleasing, performing, perfecting. And these are shame receiver behavior. Shame receiver cannot say no. Shame receiver take care of everything. They care for everyone. Shame receiver feel responsible for everyone's well-being and everything. And they burn out fast. Some shame receiver become very controlling, micromanaging everyone. And some shame receiver, they run away from the pain of shame. They seek comfort and soothing in the world of pornography. And pornography become a highly addictive pain relief medication for that person. I want to tell you, if the shame receiver is not facing her shame or his shame and the pain, eventually the shame receiver will become a shame giver. A shame receiver will become a shame giver to his or her spouse and to the children. And that's how shame perpetuates from generation to generation. And these are some of the shame giver behavior: abusive, hostile, uninvolved, critical, punishes harshly, speak truth without grace, use the word should, use the words you should have known better, invalidate you, rolling the eyes, being sarcastic, joke at your expense, overstep your boundary, remind you that you are worthless, communicate that you are not good enough, inadequate, a pain. We look at the gospel scene. We look at the culture. Now look at the game plan of the Pharisees and the scribes. The Pharisee and the scribe have a game plan, have a plot, and that is they want to trick Jesus into tension between justice and mercy. What is your sentence, Jesus? If Jesus say, apply justice and stone the woman, they would say Jesus is not merciful. If Jesus says, spare the woman and show her compassion, they would say Jesus know nothing about justice. That's the plot. It's a trick. Now, what happened next, the next act, is totally unexpected by everyone in the temple court. And unexpected, including you and I. Verse 6. Jesus stooped down and rolled on the ground with his fingers. See, Jesus doesn't want to look at the woman because in doing so, looking at her, he's joining the community to participate in shaming her. Jesus, God in incarnation, does not come into our world to shame us. He comes into our world to identify with us and show us solidarity. Jesus comes into our world to show us how we should live. To live with generosity. To live with hospitality. To live with justice. To live with compassion. By not participating in shaming her, Jesus telling the woman, you are not alone. You're not on your own. Emmanuel, God with you, God with us. Jesus knows in a short period of time, he will be just like the woman, half naked, totally alone, totally abandoned, and the whole world shame him on the cross. Just like the whole community shaming the woman. Folks, I want to let you know, this is very important to know. To know, understand, and keep it not in your mind, keep it in our heart. Jesus is not just our guilt offering. Jesus also our shame bearer. He bears our shame. How did Jesus bear our shame? Jesus bore our shame in two distinctive ways. When he was spat upon, when he was exposed on the cross. In Old Testament time, spitting someone in the face was a gesture of contempt, a deliberate insult. In Old Testament, Job was spat upon. In Job 30 and 10, they abhor me, they stand aloof from me, and do not refrain from spitting in my face or at the sight of me. Job not only lost his children, his wealth, his health, he lost his honor and dignity as a person. Jesus was spat upon during the course of his suffering. Matthew 27, 30, and they spat on him and took the staff and struck him on the head. Mark 15, 19, and they struck his head with a staff and make a bamboo-like reed and spat on him and kept bowing their knees in homage to him. Jesus foretold this would happen two different times. When he was on earth, Mark 10, 34, they will mock him and spit on him and whip him and put him to death. And after 3 days, he will rise again from there. In Luke chapter 18, 32, for he will be handed over to the Gentile, who will make sport and scoff and jeer at and insult and spit upon. And centuries before Jesus become flesh, the word spoke through Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 50, verse 6. I gave my back to the smiters and my cheek to those who pluck off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. Notice how the phrase shame and spitting go together, Isaiah prophecies. Jesus actually bore our shame when he was spit upon so we could be emotionally healed of shame and disgrace. We don't have to carry our shame and our shame tapes anymore. We don't have to medicate our pain of shame anymore with food, with shopping, with porn, with work, with ministry, with a person who's not our spouse. And Jesus sees things differently. Things don't have to be this way. We don't have to choose between mercy and justice. In verse 7, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. The scribes and Pharisees thought that in order to maintain a sense of wholesomeness in the community, they have to get rid of the woman who is the pollutant, contagious, a scapegoat. But Jesus said, look at yourself first. There's no scapegoat in the family. There's no scapegoat in the church. There's no scapegoat in the community. And looking at yourself first is a constant, consistent teaching of Jesus. Matthew 7, 1 to 5. First, get the beam of timber out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the tiny particle out of your own brother's eye. In Luke chapter 18, 9 to 14, for everyone who exalts himself will be humble, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Things don't have to be this way, folks. Things don't have to be this way. Things don't have to be this way when your wife is asleep, you turn on the smartphone and look at pornography. Things don't have to be this way. You're texting a female co-worker and you don't want your wife to read the text messages. Things don't have to be this way. You don't give your husband a chance to help at home. Things don't have to be this way. You compare him to other men. Things don't have to be this way. You criticize his family. Things don't have to be this way. That you don't take his point of view seriously. Things don't have to be this way, that you work so much, you don't do your share of parenting, household chore, and meal preparation. Things don't have to be this way, that you make your wife feel so alone in her dream to have a place in your life where your parents could not interfere. Things don't have to be this way. That your wife, you make your wife feel so alone in her fears with your anger. Things don't have to be this way, often in a bad mood. Things don't have to be this way. You think you do more than he does. Jesus telling the woman, you're not alone. You're not on your own. Emmanuel, God with you. Jesus telling her, I identify with you. I stand alongside with your shame and your suffering. I am with you. Jesus telling the scribes and Pharisees, the whole community, things don't have to be this way. Examine yourself first. Now, the community listens, conscience stricken. One by one, young and old, men and women left. I have a hunch that someone is so stricken by his or her conscience, they will put some clothing on the woman to cover her up, to restore, to help restore her honor and dignity as a person. Verse 10 to 11. When Jesus raised himself up, he said to the woman, woman, where are your accuser? Have no men condemned you? She answered, no, sir, no, Lord. And Jesus said, I do not condemn you either. Go on your way, and from now on, sin no more. You know, folks, Jesus knew right and wrong. Our God knows right and wrong. He knew the woman had sinned. But Jesus often make those who he contacted feel better about themselves. In doing so, people felt connected with him. Go on your ways. It's not about, okay, I don't condemn you now, go home now, and you sin no more right away, instantly. No. Go on your way is about following Jesus. Go on your way is about healing. And following Jesus and healing does not happen in isolation. Following Jesus and healing happen in a community of safe people. Like here, this is a community of safe people. Amen? I heard a Franciscan priest once said, it has always been much easier to worship Jesus than to follow him. Following Jesus demands care for the supposedly unworthy. It demands care for the sinners. Demand care for the outsiders. It demands care for the non-observers of the law. Such a lifestyle makes you feel friends. When religion remains a mere belonging system instead of a transformation system, it becomes a closed country club. For the healthy, instead of an always open hospital for the weak and the ailing, which is just about all of us. Isn't this so true, folks? It's always easier to worship Jesus on a Sunday morning than to follow Jesus the rest of the week, the rest of the month, the rest of the year. And it's the hardest to follow Jesus when no one is watching. It's hardest to follow Jesus when no one is watching. But remember the Gospel of Luke chapter 5, Jesus never said to Levi, the tax collector, "Worship me." He did say to Levi, "Follow." Go on your way is about calling a lifetime of discipleship with Jesus, calling to a journey, a life journey walking with Jesus. And I bet Jesus wants to walk every step of this journey together with you and I. And the more we walk with Jesus, the more we find out our Heavenly Father is a good Father. In good times, bad times, and worse times. Go on your ways about growing up with Jesus, about maturing with Jesus, to be raised with Jesus. In contemporary terms, Jesus is calling this woman to get up, rise up, face your problem, face your pain, face your shame. Stop running away. You and your husband to talk to a counselor. Your husband talk to a doctor. Talk to a minister. Identify the root problem associated with the affair. And find out what's missing in the marital environment. Begin a journey that brings healing to this severe, severe relationship injury caused by the affair. Folks, if you want your pain and your shame and your struggle with pornography, relationship and marriage to grow and get bigger, practice these three things. Secrecy. Silence. Judgment. Secrecy, silence, judgment. Jesus calling the opposite. Go on your way and seek some help. Seek some counsel. This is a way of coping with your struggle or your life without pushing love away. That's what we talked about yesterday morning. To do things not to push love away. Secrecy, silence, and judgment. Push love away. So people ask me, Dr. Shea, how do I face my shame? How to face our shame? First, the first thing, you have to name the shame. To name it. This is a shame tape. This is a shame attack. I tell you why. It's called name it and face it. You have to treat shame as a person, like a Mr. Shame or Miss Shame. Mr. Shame doesn't like you to find out his real name, and his real name is Shame. He doesn't mind you calling him different name. He doesn't mind you calling him insecure, low self-esteem, anger, depression, lack of confidence, anxiety. He doesn't mind you call him all these different names, but what he really don't want you to call him is shame. That's his real name. Why? When you call him his real name, the power of that name begin to diminish. When you call him his real name, this is shame. This is shame attack. And you begin to separate yourself, your person, you as a person, and your worth from shame. And my mission as a counselor, as a psychologist, is to help my client to name the shame and give them tools to face them. Folks, I want to tell you one thing. The opposite of shame is respect. The opposite of shame is respect. Not just to respect I'm a precious child of God, but to respect there is right and wrong, to respect that people are different with different journey, their different opinion, their different way of doing things, including running a home, running a church, running a business, even running a country. And to respect that each one of us have an unspoken story, we are not here to judge. To respect that God has a different plan for each one of us, respect that life is not fair. Life is not fair. To respect that sometimes there's no simple answers. To respect that sometimes there's no answer for a long time. To respect that there are things we have no control. To respect that we are not responsible for everything. And to respect that some things in life cannot be fixed. They can only be carried. Some things in life cannot be fixed. They can only be carried. To respect that there's no greater act for others than to acknowledge someone's pain and to say, I am here with you. To respect that when it comes to struggle pornography, you cannot do it on your own. You cannot fix it by your own strong will and resolve. Respect that you need to seek counsel. And to respect what God is most interested in, that He inspects our life, and that is, when you die and go to heaven and you meet God in person, God is not going to say to you, why didn't you become a saint? Why didn't you discover the cure for cancer? Why didn't you change the world? No, all God will ask you at that holy time is, why didn't you become you? Why didn't you become you? And that is the words of Elie Wiesel, one of the best known survivors of the Holocaust. Why didn't you become you? Most of all, to respect that when we hold that bread in our hand, when we cup that bread in our hand, that bread of the Eucharist, stretching out and hear a voice saying, this is my body broken for you. This is Christ's body broken for you. At that moment, everything changed. At that moment, everything changed. We are not here to run our shame tapes. We are not here to allow shame to attack us. We are here to run our respect tape. Jesus not only took our sin on the cross, and He bore our shame on the cross too. And that is the true power of the gospel. Jesus not just only took our sin on the cross. He bore our shame on the cross. And that's the true power of the gospel. A mother writes a letter to her daughter, reminding her to respect herself. And this is her letter to her daughter. You do not have to be someone's version of you to be lovable. You do not have to be someone's version of you to be lovable and worthy of belonging. You don't need to shrink down in body, voice, thought, or action to be lovable. You already are lovable. You never have to feel shame for being who you are. It's okay to feel lots of big emotions, even lots of big emotion at the same time. You can come to me to talk about them and figure out what to do about them. We'll learn together how to move through the difficult things in life together. I'm sorry for letting my hang-ups, my fear to get in the way of your freedom and creativity. I'm sorry for when I make you think my frustration and confusion were because you were not good enough. I'm sorry for not saying I am sorry enough. Your body does not make you valuable. Your body does not make you valuable. And at the same time, your body is an important part of who you are. It is what makes you alive, makes you capable, makes you strong in the world, able to get, able to give, and make love, and hold the ones you love. You're not an object which anyone is allowed to use. If you can help it, try not to compare yourself with other people around you, especially when it comes to your look. Let them be them and you be you. Take joy in the special things other people offer the world without worrying that takes away from the special thing you offer to the world. You're not a mistake. You are totally and completely enough, just as you are. On this Sunday morning, here in this faith community, let us take a pause and remind ourselves that we are not on our own. Emmanuel, God with us. Let us remind ourselves things don't have to be this way. The prodigal son came to himself. The prodigal son came to his senses in the Gospel of Luke chapter 15, 17. He came to realize things don't have to be this way. And he got up and returned to his father. He's not returning to a house. He's not returning to a business. He's returning to a person. He's returning to his father, his dad. Folks, there's an offer of salvation. There are options for change. Jesus calls us to follow him, to get up, rise up, grow up, to be raised with him, to mature with him, to face our problem, face our pain, face our shame, and stop running away, and stop self-medicating ourselves with porn, with other women and other men. Stop self-medicating ourselves with work or even ministry. Things don't have to be this way. Jesus is calling us to seek help, to bring healing and growth, maturity to our lives, our relationship at home, and to our marriage and relationship. This is Jesus' demands as well as invitation for all of us. Now, let's go back to the gospel scene. Let's go back to the temple court. The scribes and Pharisees have left. The crowds of people have left. The woman has left. And Jesus has left to another town. The temple court is empty. How come some of us still linger in the temple court, holding onto our own stone of shame? The temple court is empty. How come some of us are still holding on to this stone of shame? How come some of us still hold on to a stone and wanting to shame someone on social media because that person have a different political view or that person cheer for a different soccer team? How come some of us still want to work harder than Jesus, the pleasing, the performing, the perfecting, the pleasing, the performing, the perfecting, as if the work of Jesus on the cross and our shame bearer is not hard enough? How come some of us still want to hold on to this stone of shame? As the worship team comes up to play Come As You Are, let us lay down our burden. Let us lay down this stone of shame in front of the cross, in front of Jesus. He bear our shame already. We don't need to hold on to it. Let us lay down our burden, lay down our shame in front of the cross, and we come to love ourselves, to accept ourselves as we are, truly for God's sake. Thank you very much.